We have a few content notices for this episode. In our deep dive, we talk about pedophilia, fascism, and cults, all in relationship to the film.
Ridiculously Queer podcast, where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the fire always burning somewhere on the island.
Love it, love it. I'm Pace, and I am the maypole, which is the phallus, which is the penis.
And I'm Howard, and I'm the salmon of knowledge.
Love it. We are so happy to have Howard David Ingham with us. Howard, they them pronouns, is the writer of the Bram Stoker Award nominated book We Don't Go Back, A Watcher's Guide to Folk Horror, and more recently of Cult Cinema, A Personal Exploration of Sects, to be clear, Brainwashing and Bad Religion in Film and TV. Howard is also the co-host of Birdcast, the Nigel Neal podcast. Welcome.
Hi, it's a real honor to be here. I'm really happy that you asked me along.
Awesome.
Yeah. Us as well. Glad to have you here, for sure.
Yeah. This has been a long time in the making, folks, because there's been a lot of email tag and stuff for this whole season. So I'm so glad we finally got this set up. I was kind of like hoping, like, maybe if we wait long enough, we could just release it and to tie in with May Day, but it's okay. We're going to release it in January, Christmas episode.
It would be the 50th anniversary of the events of the Wicker Man.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's right.
Maybe we'll have to like re-release.
Yeah. We'll do something special. We'll do a movie commentary at very least for it.
Ooh, yeah.
A Wicker Man splaining episode.
Yeah. I like it.
I love it. We'll make straw man arguments for everything. It'll be great.
Oh, nice, nice. Nice puns there.
I try.
So, few quick announcements. Reminder, we have our live show coming up January 5th in Washington, D.C. Go to qcfconf.org to register. You don't have to be there in person. It's also a hybrid, so you can watch it over Zoom and stuff through their meeting. So just have to register for it. So go to that. It's also linked in the show notes. And then we're going through our Advent Mist for Me movie calendar. So real quick shout out to some of the movies we've watched for that, and maybe some recommendations that you might have, Howard, for some of these.
I'm sure I can come up with something.
Yeah. So Pace and I, we also just released our movie commentary episode for Patreon supporters on Gremlins, which counts for like half of
my
the
favorite options. Christmas movie.
Oh, me too.
One of mine, at least.
The bit where Phoebe Cates explains why she hates Christmas.
Yes, yes.
It's so, so terribly brilliant. It's just. Oh, yeah. Love Gremlins so much. And Gremlins 2.
Yep, yep.
I have not seen Gremlins 2. I just watched Gremlins for the first time last year, so.
Oh, my God. You've got to see Gremlins 2. Gremlins 2 is one of the... I mean, the fact that there's an entire field of Gremlins 2 studies.
Oh, wow. Just,
there's a Twitter account called the Institute of Gremlins 2 Studies, and it's not been active for a while, but they had some fantastically hilarious takes on that movie and why it's important and why it matters, because Gremlins 2 is ridiculously meta.
Right, right.
Really meta.
I have been loving getting into like the more meta movies this season, so I'm pretty sure Gremlins 2 will come up soon for me.
Yes, yes.
So one of the categories for this past week was holiday horror. And I watched A Christmas Without Snow, which is a 1980s not categorized as horror movie, but it is horrific to me to have Christmas without snow. Also, the movie itself was kind of horrific just in the quality of the movie.
Oh, I tell you what is a really underrated and really strange Christmas movie. Pottersville. Yeah, Pottersville. Which came out a few years ago, 2016. I think it stars Michael Shannon.
Huh.
And Michael Shannon plays a guy who's married to Christina Kendrick. I think, yeah, anyway, he's a small town general store owner who discovers that his wife is cheating on him, is leaving him for the sheriff, and is also secretly a furry. And he gets very drunk and accidentally hoaxes Bigfoot and then saves Christmas by perpetrating an elaborate Bigfoot hoax.
I love that.
Wow. That sounds amazing.
It is so great. People think it's like the worst Christmas movie ever, but it is so great because it's just this incredible satire on Christmas movies. Consider, it's called Pottersville. And do you know what Pottersville is? It's the nightmare alternative future of It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Love it.
So the very fact it's called Pottersville. Is that so? Yeah, you need to watch Pottersville because you probably curse me when you've seen it. But Michael Shannon perpetrating a Bigfoot hoax.
You don't see Michael
Shannon doing a lot of comedy, you know. But yeah, it's well worth it.
That sounds fantastic. Awesome. Yeah. Tonight I'm also watching Balto.
For snow?
Cool.
Yes, for
snow category. I'm watching The Shining for snow. I feel like I had to fit it into my movie calendar somewhere.
Working through Kayla Janice's House of Psychotic Women box set,
which
has a number of things. It had a great film called Identikit, which is a late period Elizabeth Taylor loses her shit movie.
Ooh. You
know, Elizabeth Taylor, towards the end of her career, did movies where she just went wrong.
Yep.
Just, like, lost her shit and went a bit insane. And Identikit is in that. There's also, a whole bunch of stuff. I forget what the one I haven't watched is, but there's another one in it called I Like Bats, which is a Czech vampire girl movie as well, which is also well worth your time. And Footprints on the Moon, an Italian movie starring the giallo heroine Florinda Bolcan.
Yeah.
And also Klaus Kinski as an astronaut. I love a giallo.
Love
an Italian stabby movie.
This
is probably completely irrelevant, but my one big advice that if you ever find yourself in an Italian horror movie of the 1970s, do not, no matter how much you want to, utter the words, "I know who the killer is, meet me out back in 5 minutes and I'll tell you."
Why would you do that? That sounds terrible. I've never even seen one and I know not to do that.
I know, and it happens all the time. In fact, this one movie I saw, which was it called? The Red Queen Kills Seven Times, which is a great movie. Trigger warning for sexual assault halfway, gratuitous sexual assault halfway through, but it's an Italian horror film, what do you expect? But that happens twice in a row at one point.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's like...
That's like it even
Dario Argento does it. It's in Deep Red. Yeah. It's like...
And you have seen a Dario Argento film, Emily. You've seen Suspiria for this season.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go. You've seen something kind of adjacent to the giallo genre.
I've actually written about 6,000 words on new Suspiria recently. I wrote old Suspiria, but I wrote a big, long analysis of new Suspiria. Which is I'm an outlier because I really like it.
I love the new Suspiria.
I really like it, and I really like the old one.
Yeah,
as well. Well, the old one's basically like sketch comedy, only horror.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, and you know, if you're sitting there and you're asking yourself, why should a dance school have a room that's full of barbed wire and nothing else?
Right.
You probably shouldn't be watching Suspiria, right? You know, it's just like, yeah. You know, you're not there for that. You know, you're not there to ask those questions because they're not supposed to make sense, you know?
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
It's awesome, awesome. Well, we'll get into the movie we're covering today.
Far too long.
No, this is all good though. But we're covering The Wicker Man, the original 1973 film directed by Robin Hardy. And so we are sadly not covering the Nicolas Cage one, which I know all of our fans are dying for. I'm saying sarcastically, but we'll get there eventually.
The sequel either.
Yeah. I have never seen.
Yeah, no, there was a sequel.
Well, there's
a. That in a minute. Yeah. You know, we'll give that. We will, you know, because I think we probably need to have a few words about the Wickerless Cage Man,
yes.
as well as the Wicker Tree,
yes,
as well, which because they do need to be mentioned because of how yep. how much they poop in the soup in terms of the original film's legacy.
Yes, really. Yes, poop in the soup. I love that now, yes. But. Before we get into that, we ask our all of our guests if they have a real life church horror story. And this can be something that's supernatural, but more often than not, it's just church people being horrific and shitty to one another. So if you have one, please go for it.
Oh, my God. So you've read Cult Cinema.
Yep,
as well.
Yeah.
You probably know this one. But I worked as a church administrator for an evangelical pastor back in about 1998 when I was with the evangelicals.
Ooh, and that's not, enough you know, in and of itself to be like,
I know.
Yep, horror.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah. And he was an abusive like employer, as well as being big on the evangelical circuit in the UK, you know, which is a lot smaller than the evangelical circuit in the US. So an evangelical church, a church in Britain that has more than 1,000 members, is in one of the 20 biggest churches in the entire country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
While, as I understand it, in some parts of the US, that's what you call fair to middling for an evangelical fellowship.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
You know, so it's a different ballgame. But back in the day, he was bringing in 300 or 400 people, which is phenomenal for my part of the country. But and he used to do this thing at the end of every service. He'd have a call. At the front, he'd have a call, and what he'd do is he'd get every time, and every time he did this, he'd get everybody to bow their heads, and if they felt moved to come to the front and be paid, prayed for, and make a faith commitment or renew their faith commitment, he said, "You put your hands up, and no one else is going to see."
Everyone always sees.
And yeah, I know everyone always sees, right? You know. Yeah. You're ruining the magic, Emily.
Sorry.
And then, you know, and he'd be there and he goes, I see you, sir. You can come to the front. We'll see you. We've got someone to pray. Yeah, thank you. I see you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And sometimes he'd get 6, 7, 8 people up the front. And yeah, one day I'm in the office and he just freely admitted that the first 3 or 4 of those were made up. He didn't see anything wrong with it. He just felt that the Holy Spirit needed a nudge.
Ooh.
Which is a bit theologically iffy in terms of historical Nicene orthodoxy, I think.
Yeah.
But an absolute crook. That wasn't just the thing. I remember doing the church website, and it's 1998, right? So
yeah, like, yeah.
The internet was different. I was designing the church website and he tried to get me to Photoshop out wrinkles and missing teeth from like the pictures of the deacons and stuff, right?
Oh.
It's so awkward. And I have so many stories about that guy. And if you read the book Cult Cinema, you will read several of them. That's a plug. Can I plug? Is it a bit too early
to
plug?
Oh, we have plenty of opportunities for plugs. Shameless. And no shaming plugs, but
so
shameless
yes.
plugs. Yes.
Please plug.
Emily, I'm gay. I have no shame. You know, right. Anyway, we're going to talk about the Wicker Man, weren't we?
Yes, yes.
Indeed. But wow, that, I, Oh, pastoral egregiances are
evangelical pastors.
Yep.
Yeah.
And speaking of it, we're talking a little bit about Ben Monroe before we started recording. And
guy.
Yeah, and he has a story. I think of any two cults, and he was telling me about how he found out he accidentally joined a cult. So that's a fun.
Oh yes, that's right. He told me that story. In fact, he let me use it in cult cinema as well.
Yep.
So that story, Ben's accidental cult story is in cult cinema.
Yeah,
as well. It's a hell of a thing. it's an MLM cult. He sort of wound up going to a weekend seminar of an MLM cult and then realized halfway through what exactly it was. Spent the rest of the next few days trying to escape and avoiding phone numbers from people going, "Where are you? You should come back, Ben."
Oh gosh, that sounds horrific. Yeah. And there's an episode of Angel, the TV show, where there's like an MLM of vampires too. So,
wow, it's years since I've even thought of that one. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or we could talk about the MLM diaconia.faith, but we're not going to do that. Okay. Anyway.
I've got a lot of thoughts about obviously cults and stuff and things. And I wrote a folk horror book and I wrote a book about cult cinema and I cover the Wicker Man in both of them. The Wicker Man as an example of cults in movies and the Wicker Man as an example of a folk horror film. In fact, it's the folk horror film.
Right.
Like, it's the quintessential, like, touchstone folk horror film. Like, the thing, because it introduces a whole bunch of tropes in folk horror that we probably need to talk about. Like the pagan village conspiracy.
Yeah.
And it's not the first thing to do a pagan village conspiracy. But it's the first one to be, like, it's the iconic pagan village conspiracy. You couldn't have Midsummer without the Wicker Man.
Okay.
Or anything like that. Or you couldn't have a whole bunch of stuff without the Wicker Man. You see things and they have the Wicker Man twist. So the Netflix series Archive 81.
Yeah.
That's got the Wicker Man twist in it.
It does. You're so right. I just,
literally the Wicker Man twist.
Oh, and I just... And they didn't bring it back for a second season. I love that show. Ugh.
Yeah. They left it on a cliffhanger. You see, that's why Netflix shows tend to like try and do one and done these days, because they never know if they're going to come back for a second season. And this is important, because The Wicker Man is... in the UK, it was called The Citizen Kane of horror movies.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be the greatest British horror movie. Ever made, we're going to talk about the background of the film as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, all of this is useful context, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
It's fascinating to me. So this was my first time ever watching Wicker Man, because I don't know if you know, but our listeners know, I am not a horror person. Like, horror movies have never been my...
You're literally doing a horror podcast.
Right.
I'm co-hosting. I am not creator.
They are my horror Padawan. So I've been kind of walking them through horror. And so they bring the outsider perspective. And I'm the one like saying, here's this really weird Italian horror film that you've never heard of that makes no sense. And let me just throw you in there without any warning and see what happens.
And then I literally say, why is there all this barbed wire?
Yeah, right. But it's got a kicking soundtrack that stays in your head for days.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that as a podcast dynamic, by the way. But the guy I do Birdcast with, John, he also does a podcast called Jewish Signore in Giallo, which is about Italian horror movies. It's a great podcast, and everybody should listen to Jewish Signore in Giallo. And John is basically the Padawan in that one. In Birdcast, the Nigel Neal one, he's the guy who knows shit about Nigel Neal and about British cinema and TV history. And I'm the one going, ooh, that has interesting things to say about society and stuff, probably. But yeah, the other one is John does Jewish Signore with a guy called Dave Thomas, and they essentially watch an Italian horror movie and come out of that and go, well, that was horrible. And then, but Dave explains about it and who these people are and the other films I made and all that sort of thing. And John's basically like, they're going, I never want to see that again, or whatever. You know, it's actually very entertaining for a podcast with two straight guys on it, because obviously we need more of those. But yeah, it's one of my favorites. I'm very, even if it's just like it's actually friends doing it, I just love listening to them just like do it in that kind of way. So it's a good dynamic. The Wicker Man.
So when did you first, like, do you remember when you first saw it?
I first saw The Wicker Man when I was a teenager. It was shown on a BBC Two series, which was hugely influential at the time in the 1990s. It was called Moviedrome. And every Saturday night, Alex Cox, who's better known for directing Sid and Nancy and Repo Man, he would appear and he would curate a series of cult movies with a little 5-minute thing. So Moviedrome is where I first saw Philip Kaufman's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, the sort of like ice cold 1978 remake. It's where I first saw The Stepford Wives. Was it The Stepford Wives on that? It was around that time. And a lot of other movies like that. And The Wicker Man was there. But I can't remember if I went into The Wicker Man unspoiled. Mm. I had the wonderful... Obviously, I'm just assuming that everybody listening to this podcast has seen The Wicker Man or is going to see The Wicker Man. And if you are going to see The Wicker Man, turn it off, watch The Wicker Man, and then come back.
Because
The Wicker Man has one of the most kick-ass twists in cinema history. And it's also one of those twists that people kind of know. I have a 14-year-old son, and I showed him The Wicker Man the other week. I was like, we want to do a movie night, what do you want to do? And he's like, I want to see The Wicker Man because it's on the front of your book and everybody said, you know, it's supposed to be like this film that's great. And I'm like, okay, let's watch Wicker Man. And he came out, he was unspoiled all the way through, and he had a kind of holy shit moment at the end, which was beautiful. About halfway through, he's like, they're in a cult. This is wrong. And then at the end, it's like, they're right here all along. And it's just so great. I did that with him the same effect of the Planet of the Apes had the same effect on him.
Yeah,
actually, because I showed it that to him when he was about 9, and which is a perfect age to first see Planet of the Apes. And you know, his eyes were like saucers when Charlton Heston sees the Statue of Liberty and starts punching the beach. And damn you all to hell! But yes. Actually, The Wicker Man and Planet of the Apes are kind of important, and this is relevant. This isn't just me going off on one, because my ADHD will make me go off in strange places, but...
You're in good company, then.
I'm glad. The Wicker Man and Planet of the Apes are unique in my collection for both having the twist ending printed on the front of the DVD cover of the copies I have. And that's because they're both films where even if you've never seen them, you have a greater than 0% chance of knowing the twist. Hmm. I think you could probably also include in that category The Sixth Sense. There are a couple of others. And this is why... When I had the privilege of interviewing Ari Aster a few years back, just after he made Midsommar, he told me that he'd made a point of not watching The Wicker Man or Blood on Satan's Claw or Witchfinder General or any other folk horror movie when he was making Midsommar. Because, you know, he was approached by a Swedish film company who said, can you make us a Swedish folk horror movie?
Yeah.
So he's like, I'll make a folk horror movie. I'll make the bad guys Nazis. And seriously, there's like fascist slogans on banners above the road going in there in Swedish. A wonderfully queer Swedish friend called William Vicklund, or Wikipedia, as his friends call him, as their friends call them. Sorry, William. As their friends call them. They confirmed that those were indeed far-right slogans everywhere in Helsingland. But Ari Aster didn't watch The Wicker Man. He still made a film that's pretty much The Wicker Man.
Yep.
And that's really important because Wicker Man basically is the folk horror movie more than the other two original folk horror films that are included in like the Unholy Trinity that folk horror fans talk about. Blood on Satan's Claw and Witchfinder General is the best of the three. It is the one that has influenced more movies than any of the others. It's really important. And also, you know, I guess we're going to talk about Christopher Lee and Edward Woodward in a bit as well.
Yep.
I take it. So have you seen, so you've only just watched Wicker Man for the first time, is it, Emily?
Well, I'm waiting for Emily. I guess I can say the first time I've seen it, which is the twist was ruined for me because I watched the Nicolas Cage version first.
Oh no.
Back when it came out, I watched it in 2006. I thought it was a very bad movie. And so I did not watch this movie. I did not watch this movie for a very long time because of that. Can you hear now, Emily?
Yes, I can. Okay,
yeah. Yay. So I was just saying that.
Back in the room.
Yep. I was just telling Howard that the first time I watched Wicker Man was actually the remake, which is so bad. You have not seen that yet, but so you have no idea how bad it is, but it is bad.
Yeah.
Somebody in a bear costume. It's right.
Because I saw that and it was so bad and it shared the same title, I refused to watch this movie because I thought it would also be bad. Until about like 5 years ago, I finally watched it because, you know, it's a horror classic everybody keeps talking about, so I'll watch it. And I'm like, holy shit, this is like a musical. I love it. This is like a folk little singing musical this is the weirdest, funnest, wildest film.
It's such a weird film, isn't it?
Yes. Pace can attest to this. When we were watching it, I was like, I could not figure it out for a while because I was like, I'm used to cops are bad because cops are bad.
Yeah.
And then it was like, but he's like investigating a missing kid, a potentially murdered kid. And that's like, yeah, like you don't want to kill kids. That's bad. And then there's like the really over the top Christian morality stuff and like all of those different things coming in at the same time. And I was just like, and then the song, and I literally said to Pace, I was like, can you even have a horror musical, which like, yes, it's a false binary, but also like the list that Pace gave me, I was like, Rocky Horror Picture Show is not a horror. Little Shop of Horrors, I didn't think, like, the
they
list
both have
of, like,
horror in the title, first
yeah,
of all,
but they're but... not, like, horror. I think of horror, and I think Sweeney something that Todd. Will scare me.
Sweeney Todd the might scare
the
you.
Wicker Man is Sweeney... that, and the thing is, right, The Wicker Man is a horror film that has a musical in it. And also, the musical elements are particularly unsettling because Sergeant Howie, Edward Wood's protagonist, doesn't know he's in a musical. So he keeps walking into these musical numbers. And they are very much musical numbers. The bit where Willow sings Willow's song with a hilariously obvious butt double is...
yes.
...is obviously a musical number because she sings Britt Eklund mimes directly into the camera. She breaks the fourth wall in the way that you only do in a musical.
Yeah.
The Maypole number. Who are they singing to?
Exactly.
It's like a random kid with a Jew's harp there. It only makes sense as a musical number.
Mm-hmm.
The Landlord's Daughter.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Where they just sing this ridiculously filthy song about Britt Eklund and she just acts like it's hilarious.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because it turns out she really does do all that stuff. Spoilers. But yes. It's such a weird movie. You talk about the over-the-top morality of it. You've got to bear in mind that Sergeant Howie is presented as someone from the Presbyterian Church of Scotland.
Mm.
And Scottish Calvinism is tremendously humorless, tremendously judgmental, and tremendously conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And not conservative in the way that a conservative evangelical in the US or even particularly in England now would be. Mm-hmm. The conservatism is a conservatism that comes from a very old school morality, very high band, that comes from living in a kind of cold, bleak, and forbidding place. You have a cold, bleak, and forbidding
theology.
And the sort of, so, and you know, and Scottish Calvinism is a miserable theology anyway, let's be honest. It's not fun. But it's a different sort of evangelicalism. Someone like Sergeant Howie wouldn't recognize a Franklin Graham as being an evangelical. Definitely wouldn't recognize a televangelist or anything, or any of like your moral majority in the States, because mm-hmm. because the thing that is different about that old school Calvinism is that it is sincerely ascetic in the way it goes. Asceticism is central to it. And Sergeant Howe is quite an ascetic guy. You know, he's mm-hmm. like, he's not someone who fulfills his urges, which is one of the reasons they want him, because they give him plenty of chances to do things that would actually break his asceticism, or indeed, mm-hmm. you know, he gets the chance to bang Britt Eklund.
Yeah. And then he wouldn't be the perfect sacrifice.
He wouldn't be the perfect sacrifice.
He could save himself.
Yes. Obviously, spoilers, just for those of you who, for some reason, are listening, this will only make sense if you realize that he goes to the island looking for a kid who's missing, only to discover that he's being led up a massive garden path, and it's actually him they wanted to sacrifice all along.
Yep.
And that's the twist.
But that what you're saying brings up to me, we'll just jump around because this is more fun this way, when we can lean into our ADHD stuff instead of following a outline.
I
but
have,
like
I have a diagnosis document with severely impaired written on it, let me tell those of you listening, this is why. Okay.
I also like and so it's one of those things that if I'm not like on point, this is where I go to, and I'm so glad when I can just lean into this and be more myself as opposed to following a
and this is the season for it
five strategy
our like nightmare dream season dreams are not linear, so I'm here for it.
But what I was going to say, though, is like talking about like this asceticism of Sergeant Howie, the foil for that, then I'm just realizing, is this really camp aesthetic of like we're having this musical, we're having this over the top, exaggerated, ritualistic moments. These it just really leans into camp in a way that I don't think I've fully realized until you're just talking about that, because then that creates a really fun foil for the asceticism of Sergeant Howie.
And it's also a trap that you can fall into when you're watching the film, because the pagans are a lot more fun. They're a lot more charming and that sort of thing, which is why for many years, the most depressingly orthodox take on the Wicker Man is, I think the pagans are the goodies. You know, and film criticism has that kind of weird orthodoxy in The Wicker Man, where it's like the bad guys are actually the good guys. Mind blown. And it's like, no, they're not. And there are reasons why they are not.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure we'll explore. Right. But they're not. They're grooming kids. And I mean that in the sense that a horrible turf might use it, you know, like the kind of like, but then that's about the conservatism of the film, because that's another thing that we need to talk about. It's a conservative film.
Mm-hmm.
It's conservative because Sergeant Howe is actually supposed to be the goodie. It's conservative because the Islanders are doing what a conservative filmmaker thinks that pagans are actually going to do. Because the thing about the pagan village conspiracy as a trope is that there's no such thing in the real world.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as a pagan village conspiracy, but it's all over horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they're, and the like cop as good Christian colonizer is all over reality. And yet it's still portrayed in the film and as...
I don't think Sergeant Howie's faith is necessarily seen as an admirable thing, but he's still in the film presented as doing, quote, good police work, unquote. Mm-hmm. And at the point at which, towards the end, of course, he finds he's trapped on the island because they've broken, because they bust his seaplane and he can't escape to get her back up. So he's got to do it on his own. He basically does a search of the island and desperately does all sorts of foolhardy and heroic things to try and save young Rowan from the cult that he is certain will sacrifice her on the morning of May Day 1973. Which is also, and again, the film is very much solidly placed in a time and a date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's fun. And there's a lot of fun. It's one of the very few horror films, in my opinion, that you could call delightful.
I think. And that brings to a little piece of the trivia about the behind the scenes, which is that at this point, Christopher Lee was such a horror icon, but he always plays these like dark, foreboding sort of characters, like in the Hammer Dracula films and stuff like that. And so it's like, finally we get like, he's still this horror bad guy sort of person here. Yeah, it's just so fun and a different take on it, and you can see how much fun he's having. And that was actually part in the research for behind this, like he was actually looking for that, and that was kind of one of the inspirations, was to kind of take it in a different way than he had been kind of typecast as. So
they do love their divinity lessons.
yes.
That should be the tagline for this episode, by the way. They do. But it's interesting. When Christopher Lee died, he played Saruman the White 4 times. He played Count Dooku 2, which is what my son knew him as, being a big Star Wars nerd. He played Dracula 11 times.
Wow.
He was the protagonist. He was the good guy in The Devil Rides Out. He played Frankenstein's monster. But every single obituary of Christopher Lee singled out as his finest role Lord Summerisle in The Wicker Man, which I think is probably the most complex role Christopher Lee ever played. Because it's actually a very complex individual, a very complex figure. He's not straightforward. I think that's one of the things about the film that makes it a lot better than it could have been. I think Edward Woodward and Christopher Lee make the film a lot better than they could. The casting is great, right down to like the camp landlord of the inn and Britt Eklund's miming. Ingrid Pitt randomly put in as a librarian. Ingrid Pitt, Countess Dracula herself, is the librarian. And you've got to bear in mind, Robin Hardy wasn't actually, bless him, he's dead now, but he wasn't actually that great a director. He only directed 3 films, and they are the other two aren't very good. Particularly his last film, which he kickstarted around 2013, I think, which was a sequel, a sort of half sequel to The Wicker Man, called The Wicker Tree, which has Christopher Lee in it for 57 seconds. I know I timed it.
Okay, but is it the next year where we find out if the harvest actually like got better or not?
No, it's not. It's not.
Disappointing.
It's depressing. It's set in a different Scottish pagan village conspiracy.
Oh,
but
well, in that
the,
case.
But the villain has a flashback where, as a boy, he's being told about the truth of the sacrifice by his dad, Christopher Lee. And that's really the only connection, because The Wicker Tree is terrible. It's so bad. You think that a couple of American evangelical missionaries going to Scotland, who are a couple, but they're both virgins because they're doing the silver ring thing. You'd think, and you know, being run a merry dance by a bunch of, you know, funny Scottish pagans might actually be a fun film. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's so crushingly depressing. As is the 2006 remake.
Yeah.
Another thing the Wicker Man has in common with Planet of the Apes.
The remake.
God awful early 2000s remakes by directors who should know better.
Yes.
Nicolas Cage, I have a t-shirt with Not the Bees on it. which a friend gave me for my birthday.
My
mate Carrie gave it to me for my birthday, and it's I treasure that shirt. But I actually interviewed Ari Aster wearing it. But the whole film that Nicolas Cage gives classic. Nicolas Cage loses his shit performance.
Yeah,
that's most of his performances. Yeah,
but you have scenes from the 1973 original transplanted word for word to a different context, and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these scenes are word for word.
Yeah.
You'd think it's sort of weird how literal the translation is, and what they've done is that they've made it a matriarchal pagan cult in the US.
Yeah, it's like an island off of Washington State or something, if I remember correctly. It's weird.
Yeah, it's an interesting summer island.
So basically, yeah. It's Holden. For Emily, we know what I'm talking about. But no.
Holden Village.
Yeah. It's part of it, though, is like they drained the fun out of this film when they remade it. And that's part of the reason why it just doesn't translate, is because it's a little lifeless now.
Also, I like want to watch the remake. I had no desire. No, I didn't even know it existed, and I had no desire. And then y'all are like,
"See the remake?"
Yes.
You want to watch the remake because you think, "How bad can it be?"
Right.
I mean, Nicolas Cage. He's always fun to watch, right?
I mean, no. And
all
but,
those
yeah.
things. All you need to do, right, is go to YouTube and find the Not the Bees scene,
and then I'll be good.
And then you'll be good, right?
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Because it will give you a sense of just how bad the film is. And it's also the single most entertaining thing in the entire movie. Right? It's like, oh God, my eyes, not the bees. Yeah. So you get a sense in the 1973 Wicker Man that the pagans are just running a merry dance around Sergeant Howie, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
They're all having a lovely time in their conspiracy to murder and their relentless grooming of children to do problematically sexualized things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seriously, if someone from social services had gone with Howie to the island, it would be called safeguarding issues. So many safeguarding issues on Summer Isle.
Yeah,
because everybody's
yeah.
going on about, oh, but they're also sex positive. But it's like, actually, no, listen
penis.
To how they're talking about yeah. sex to those kids. Actually, like, they've got 14-year-old girls dancing naked over a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And a middle-aged man watching approvingly from his window.
That's yep. Susanna, who is a friend of the podcast and has been on she's a former, our listeners know, but she was a former now New Jersey president for the National Organization for Women. So like when it comes to how women are portrayed and like the villainization of women and the like mysticization of uteruses and pregnancy and virginity and like nobody knows how it happens. You just run over this magical fire and get pregnant. And she and I were watching it together last night too, and she had a lot to say about
yeah. I think
yeah.
It's really interesting because that sort of thing, because another thing that's actually problematic in the Wicker Man is that the pagans are the goodies for many years was the orthodox take. Mm-hmm. Now it's the outright take.
Mm.
The folk horror scene has a lot of fash in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of fash in cottagecore and folk horror.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. A lot of right-wing people, very right-wing people, really, really like that. And there's a lot, in the UK particularly, paganism is a hotbed of the far right.
Interesting.
But, you know, and so you actually have, like I've got a friend who specifically, he's the chairman of Asatru UK, which is specifically the left-wing Nordic pagan organization in the UK.
Mm.
And it's not the biggest one, but it's the left-wing one. And the fact that you have to have an anti-racist Nordic pagan organization that exists in the first place is telling in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the Wicker Man, and you see also there's a certain sort of strand of libertarianism, and you know, the libertarian to fascism pipeline is wide and has a lot of things going in it.
Yep.
But
yeah,
there's a libertarian thinker called Hakeem Bey. Peter Lamborn Wilson. Is this familiar to you guys?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so he wrote an essay called The Temporary Autonomous Zone.
Okay.
Hugely popular. It is in late 80s, early 90s. It's hugely popular with tech libertarians back then. Right, so like people like Are You Serious in the Mondo 2000 crowd were very into the temporary autonomous zone thing. And I wound up having to read it for a philosophy club I was part of because I'm the fun kind of person who goes to philosophy clubs. And one of the people who was in that philosophy club is a probation worker in prisons. And he read this book and he went, without knowing anything about Hakeem Bey or Peter Lamborn Wilson, whose real name is Peter Lamborn Wilson, went, this guy's a paedophile. And I had already, I'd read it, and I'm like, this is a bit weird. I'm going to look him up. Yeah, he's in Nambla. So, yeah, like, the thing about the temporary autonomous zone is that it's the idea of, like, a libertarian neo-feudalist kind of society which is free from the wider mores of convention and allows people to live in pirate states. The sort of the idea of the pirate state, which is very sort of like attractive, particularly, you know, attractive to queer people as well. The idea that we might, except it keeps bringing up little boys. And it's like that kind of, that strand of paganism draws from that sort of thing. You also have, for instance, the strand of paganism that gave us Marion Zimmer Bradley as well, of the Winds of Avalon.
Yeah.
Who's I don't know how much you know about like the horrible things associated with Marion Zimmer Bradley. Famous fantasy writer, prolific child abuser, particularly of her own kids, daughter.
Gotcha.
You know, and it's kind of like everybody was like, when these things came out, because her daughter's an adult now, obviously, and Bradley and her husband are dead. When all this came out, everybody was like, oh God, oh, I could never realize it. You just have to read her books, right? It's there.
Right,
and the same with The Wicker Man. Right. It's interesting when you look at the different cuts of the Wicker Man, because I know we're going to talk about that, but there's two different cuts and three different cuts even. There's the theatrical cut that came out was 87 minutes long. The director's cut that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, and the final cut that came out a few years before Robin Hardy died. And the final cut, the longest one, is the director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to legend, what had happened, that the Wicker Man had been cut down from 100 minutes to 87, and those 13 minutes of footage had wound up being used as landfill under a new motorway bridge and were lost forever. It turned out this was not true, and there were copies of them. And so in the late 90s, they were discovered, and they got to restore bits of it. And so there's this director's cut, which isn't really a director's cut. Essentially, what they've done is that they restored as much of the missing footage as they could, which also includes changing the order as well. So in the director's cut and the final cut, which is got a lot of the director's cut footage, but not all of it, right? They changed the order of events so that Howie is on the island for two nights and that Willow does her songy bit, her song, with the hilarious, the obvious butt double whose hair is 6 inches longer, obviously, on the second night, as opposed to the first night he turns up. Which, if you think about it, makes more sense. The film holds, the longer version of the film actually is even better than the theatrical version. Which is not so, I've not got a lot of time for director's cuts. It's like Midsommar doesn't need to be another hour long, right? Or another 40 minutes long. Midsommar is already a week long. Midsommar is a time commitment to begin with. I've seen the director's cut of Midsommar. It's just longer.
I know. That's more of the same.
It's just longer. There's lots more slow shots of like beautiful Swedish countryside. There's a couple of more scenes where Danny's boyfriend's being a bit of a shit to her. It's just longer. But The Wicker Man, those 10 minutes or so added to The Wicker Man change it. So there's a prologue at the start of the director's cut where Sergeant Howie is on his own island on the mainland. And he gets the letter. There's a scene where two other policemen, one of whom is played by a very beloved British character actor called John Hallam, basically just sort of like have a kind of like laugh about how uptight he is. They have a quiet laugh at him about how uptight he is and everything. And there's a few scenes where you sort of see that he's uptight. You see him in church with his fiance, and he does the reading in church in the prologue, and then he gets this letter, reads it out, and goes to the island. Over the course, they change the order of things. So Willow has there's a second night. Willow's song happens on the second night, and things. But it is also things like there's a scene where Lord Summerisle delivers a clearly underage boy to Willow for deflowering. And he's clearly into it because he's a 14-year-old boy and she's Britt Eklund in her heyday. But it's that happens. And that's not a beautiful thing. That's not a good, you know, it's like you look at that and you go, oh hell no. Right. So these things are there and we've got to basically it's the year 2022 now. And let's face it, I don't think that we should be being particularly sympathetic with a society that's prepared to sacrifice its most vulnerable for the sake of economics.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that ship has sailed. That ship has sailed past the adorable Scottish island. It's gone right into the North Atlantic. It's just,
I mean, it's just reality.
Yes. And I think on the one hand, pagan village conspiracies aren't real, but right-wing conspiracies to sacrifice the vulnerable are real.
We're in a pandemic.
The children is real.
And that's one of the things that I find so compelling about this film is that the camps of argument of is Howie the good guy or the bad guy, or are the pagans the good guys or the bad guys? And really none of them are good guys. And I feel like it becomes this, we have these two different kind of bents of conservatism in a sense. One is more in the liberal pagan cult, the libertarian pagan cult, and then the other is this more uptight Scottish dude. And like I feel like the film is critiquing both. It's not saying one is which is a rare thing in horror for much of horror, not in the 70s, and I would say not now, but for like the wide swath in between, you the good guy would have, or the final girl, for instance, that trope had to be flawless in order to be the heroine of the story. Whereas here we get this guy who is clearly a mess and not great in anything he's doing, and he is supposed to be the guy we're following along with, but like he's not really a good guy either. And the way he just kind of barges himself into situations that don't involve him, the ways that he's trying to force his religion on other people, and they're trying to force, but the flip side is they're trying to force their religion on him to the point of literally killing him. So like, yeah,
is Sergeant Howie trying to force his religion onto other people?
He made a cross. He makes
a cross and puts it on the gravestone. But I mean, is that him forcing his religion onto other people, or is that him just assuming that his religion is the default? And
what is the difference?
Fair point. That's a fair point. But yeah, I think he's like,
he's like the benign colonizer that's like still causing harm and doing stuff, but like isn't aware that he's causing active harm.
Who's he colonizing though? I mean, like, the fact is, he's the follower of the old religion here.
Yes, yeah.
Because their religion was made up 100 years ago.
True.
There is nothing wrong with a new religion. Neo-paganism in the UK dates back to the 1940s and not before. Druidry in Wales dates back to the 18th century and not before. Any claims that these religions have to a history before that are right up there with Christians thinking that we can go back to Adam. They are myths, they are stories, they are not facts. And the fact is, it's okay to be a new religion because all religions were new at some point.
Yes.
Some of the nicest people I ever met were Baha'is. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when Baha'i started in the 19th century, you know, like, it's just how it is. Sikhism's like 16th, 17th century, is it?
Yeah,
maybe earlier than that. My ignorance is showing up. But, you know, Islam is the 7th century. They've got, religions have a starting date. It's okay to have a starting date for a religion. But Howie's not the intruder, is the thing. Howie is discovering an intrusion. And his status quo may not be a good thing, right? But he isn't the intruder. He's not the one. He's basically witnessing colonization happening. He's being colonized.
Interesting, yeah.
And he's not the colonizer here because everybody here is white. Okay. Yeah.
But the interesting point,
he's being colonized.
Yeah, I
freaking terror because he's also a colonizer, and that's the biggest fear of the colonizer, which is why The Wicker Man is a conservative film.
That's amazing. And I think part of it is just the me getting past the fact that he is leaving a homogenous sort of culture and going into a different one, but it's by their invitation with a nefarious purpose in mind, which of course changes that whole dynamic. So yeah, I'm definitely inclined to see what you're saying now. Yeah, for sure.
I like the way you're like that. I hadn't thought of it that way. And he definitely thinks that he is, like, he doesn't know it's an invitation from them, right? For him, it is going somewhere because they are doing bad things. They are not properly moral in what they are doing. They have done something to a child. And so he's going. And I do think that he goes with a colonizer mentality, right? He is literally, as they say, enforcement of laws from the king.
Well, yeah, he's got the power of the king. Yeah, he's in the name of the king.
Yeah.
He's got a little crown on his hat.
And so like he is coming with that, and at the same time they have invited him, so it's almost like a clash of the colonizers.
It is.
Like my one sentence summary for this was Christian colonization crashes into paganism and penis worship and the cop's not happy with the results. But it seems like it's actually just like a clash of colonization.
It is.
Yeah. Also,
no one is left wing in this movie.
Yeah.
There's no lefties in this movie.
100%.
So yeah, one thing that I think a lot of people fail is that because the film is conservative, it doesn't admit ACAB as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So that Howie might be a bad Christian, but he's a good cop.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially, whatever he does is his job and his duty. If you perceive his duty as being upholding the law and being absolutely committed to stopping a child being murdered.
Yeah.
And he goes above and beyond for that, even to the extent that when he can't leave the island, he puts himself in terrible risk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He does actually behave heroically, mm-hmm. which I think is also, you know, another thing that adds to the wonderful complexity of the film, really.
Yeah.
The way that they do, particularly right, the ending where he is now caught and is being burned alive, and the framing that happens there, like it is a heroic thing. He's trying to rescue Rowan and then gets caught and then can't escape and all of those things. And that the like sacrifice, human sacrifice, martyrdom, like yeah. the complexities of that, I thought was really fascinating because it literally goes with both religions for him to die.
Yeah. Right?
For Christianity, he becomes a martyr. And Lord Summerisle knows it.
That, yeah.
Right, like, and names that theological call to martyrdom and how that plays out. And for, that was a loud car, sorry. And for their religion, it works because they need to sacrifice someone who is this particular configuration of innocence and goodness or whatever.
Innocence and experience.
Yeah.
Because he's the man who comes with the power of a king.
Mm-hmm.
He comes of his own free will, and he's a virgin.
Yep.
Because he's been saving himself, although he's obviously nearly 40. He's a 37-year-old virgin, and he's yeah. I having you know been in evangelical circles, I've known people who you know have not got married till their 30s and have you know never actually done the deed. So you know it's a thing. You know, purity culture is real.
Yeah, it's a whole other level of horror. I do appreciate whenever it is not applied to women though, like as someone who was raised and like heard about virginity and it was applied to me as part of like the class of gender that I was raised as, to then have like a guy be the virgin. We watched Hocus Pocus 2 this year, and Hocus Pocus, we did a movie commentary on Hocus Pocus, right? And the whole thing is a virgin has to light the black candle, and it's a guy who's a virgin. And so frequently virginity is so focused on cisgender white women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then to have it flipped in this way that like, no, it's this guy, like this white guy who is the virgin and who is this yeah. symbol of innocence and who then becomes the sacrifice is like a little refreshing.
I need to avoid getting on a tangent about the virginity as a class of gender from the medieval period because that's my jam, but I'm not going to do that today. We'll do that in a different episode, I'm sure.
Oh, I, I, I actually have thoughts about that. I've written about medieval saints and sex workers who became saints and stuff like that in the past. That's a Love thing it. We can talk about some other time, though.
I would say we'll have to have a medieval horror film.
Yeah, I'm thinking. What is that Sean Connery film, The Rose? What is that one where he's in the monastery? I can't think of the name. Sean Connery. Yeah,
it's based on the Umberto Eco novel. I might also recommend Anchoress.
Oh, I've not heard of that one.
Yeah, well worth it. It's in the Severin Folk Horror Box, which is, but I might be on Shudder. I don't know. You might be able to find it on streamings. But yes, Anchoress is highly recommended on that front.
Ooh. Awesome, awesome.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay, so but back to the Wicker Man. I mean... So, yeah, I mean, you talk about virginity being related to a man as being a kind of unusual thing. But you can also talk about a lot of ways in which they tend to flip around Christian narratives. So, for example, they burn the Christian.
Yes, I wrote that. I was like, they're not burning the Christian and not the witch. Yeah.
Witches didn't tend to get burned in Britain. They got hung. But yes, I mean, they still got killed, you know, it's like, but... You know,
yes, but a different...
Heretic Catholics got burned.
Interesting.
Which is a thing that people constantly forget. We didn't burn witches, we burnt Catholics.
Huh.
But the pagans are burning the Christian in this one. Mm-hmm. He's singing Psalm 23. In there, but it's drowned out by Summer Is He Coming In.
Yep.
So both are like ancient standards with traditional tunes. I mean the pagans win.
Mm-hmm.
The one point where this is actually sort of presented in a useful and interesting way for me is, however, where he's there and he basically says, you know, it's not going to work, and the only person who's going to be good enough to sacrifice next year is you. Lord Summerisle, and Christopher Lee does this fantastic moment in his performance where a shadow falls over his face,
right?
Mm-hmm. There is a split second, oh shit, he's right kind of moment.
Yep.
And then he's like, no, they're not going to fail. Not going to fail. We're going to do the ritual.
Right. And then he's going to mysteriously disappear from the island before May 1st.
All sorts of things might happen, you know. Obviously, cooperate with filmmakers, in making The Wicker Man. I love the flash at the start of The Wicker Man.
Right.
Where they're like, the filmmakers would like to thank Summerisle's Tourist Board and Laird for helping us.
Yes.
That's wonderful. I've lost count of the number of times I've seen The Wicker Man because people keep getting me to show them The Wicker Man. getting me to talk to them about The Wicker Man and that sort of thing. And The Wicker Man is one of those films that generates really bad takes on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I hope some of them aren't even mine. But, you know, I was talking about Wicker Man splaining, but that's a thing. That's really a thing. I've been Wicker Man splained. I remember being in a conversation on Twitter with Peg Alloy, who is a very knowledgeable critic on horror. She's fantastic. And she and I, basically a whole bunch of like straight white middle-aged men weighed in and told us why we were wrong. And she got it a lot worse than I did.
Yep.
Does that surprise you?
No.
No, it's not at all surprising, but it's just how it goes. There's a certain sort of person who doesn't want you to point out that the pagans in The Wicker Man are not good guys, that perhaps engaging in an elaborate conspiracy to murder for the sake of some fucking apples might not be a moral thing to do.
Right.
like,
I think it's really interesting. I'm really glad that you're on for this episode, because I, you know, have been to London once on a layover. So like my understanding of UK cultures and politics is a lot more limited. And so like the idea of the alt-right being pagan in this country is laughable in a lot of senses. Like there is,
I don't know, because
there is a like sense of like the pagan as a fun game to play, a fun thing to put on, where all the white people buy all the sage. That's like super problematic, right? Like super problematic. But so much of the alt-right in this country is so embedded in Christianity,
right,
and has such a tight grip on Christianity that the idea that they would let anyone else be alt-right with them that was a pagan is
But what about like that, the QAnon shaman?
Exactly. And like there's all that stuff about that. Yeah, there's all that stuff about like going towards Nordic religion and people who love the Thor movies because it's really about white supremacy as Asgardians and stuff like that in this country, because they're all about that kind of connecting with their Germanic and Nordic roots in very white supremacist
ways. I think you're right that it's a fringe thing, though. I mean, on the one hand, the sort of New Age pagan to Nazi pipeline is much like the libertarian to Nazi pipeline. Mm-hmm. Wide and full of poop. But you're right that, like, you know, the outright is really... When you think of the outright, you don't tend to think of Jacob Chansley. You tend to think of Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, who basically is in a sort of evangelical Christianity that's so extreme, it's actually gone over into Manichaean witchcraft in the way that it sort of expresses itself. And that kind of thing is something, I mean, here in the UK, you've got to be aware that Christianity is dying on its proverbial arse and has been for a long time. And I have lots of theories about why that is, and that's probably would take us the length of another episode of the podcast, and nobody wants that. So I think it's fair to say that there is more space among our far right for alternative expressions of spirituality. Also, you've got to bear in mind that Christianity in the UK has an establishment link that it doesn't have in the US. In fact, I would argue that people are less likely to be knowledgeable about Christian because everybody in England is already a Christian by default unless they specifically say otherwise, because the person with the pointy hat in the big house in London is the head of that church. And you know, the celebration, the separation of church and state, it's like one of our two houses of government has bishops allowed to sit in automatically. Bishops get to, archbishops get to sit in the House of Lords, or we used to. Is that still true? They keep changing it. It was definitely true when I was a kid. But yeah, bishops could until relatively recently, if they're still not doing it, sit in the House of Lords. So, like, the Church of England and the Anglican Communion, which sort of a weird thing because it's only real kind of like influx into the US is of course the American Episcopalian Church, which is not what you'd call conservative, really.
Although there's also an Anglican Church in the US now that is conservative.
Neo-trad. Yes.
Yep.
And spoilers, that means that you really don't have to love a Neo-Trad. yeah, I mean, and Harry is part of Scotland and Wales don't have institutionalized churches, but they still have a strong tradition of the church being in cahoots with society in some sort of way. So the Presbyterian mm-hmm. Church of Scotland, which Harry is a part, is actually like the closest Scotland had to an institutionalized traditional church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think it's weird, the fact that religious freedom in the UK is arguably easier because we've got an established church.
Mm.
Because all you have to do now to not be an established church is say, I'm not in the established church, when someone asks you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are no longer part of the Church of England, which is a thing. So people take it for granted and they don't really care for it. And therefore, if you are part of an active religious movement, like you're a New Ager or you're a pagan
mm-hmm.
or you're a Nordic or what, however you express that, you actually have to be fairly committed to it. And the far right element in British paganism is much bigger than a lot of pagans would be comfortable in admitting,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
And they get very angry about it. American pagans get really angry about it.
Because, I believe that.
You know, how dare you say that? But again, it's about context, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ugh, what else do we have to cover about this wild movie? There's so much. I will say there's one thing that we kind of danced around but didn't quite touch on that I wanted to touch on, which is just the specific
notion.
Well, yeah, there are the penises. we could talk about that. The phallus, well, the maple.
Love penis.
Yep. Penis, just like the Cairo candle is and stuff like that, and so it's like it's a symbol that
there's phallic imagery everywhere, right?
Yes, so that's one of the things, like Mary Daly, who says that God is a penis in the sky kind of
mm-hmm.
imagery here, but I love that. But the other thing I was thinking is that, like, one of the things that, I don't know if this is intentional or not, but this is an interpretation that I had of the film watching it this most recent time, is that at the end of the day, both religions are destined to fail. Howie still gets burned. His God doesn't mm-hmm. save him. And at the end of the day, the apples aren't going to thrive very likely from the... So there's like this sense that there isn't this salvific notion in religion. Mm-hmm. That kind of seems to be undergirding part of the story, or at least how I interpreted it watching it this most recent time.
I think it's useful that the film never actually had the planned sequel that it did. Because Anthony Schaffer, mm-hmm. the writer of The Wicker Man, wrote a screenplay for something called The Loathsome Lambton Worm, mm-hmm. which would have been a direct sequel to The Wicker Man and would have begun with Howie's colleagues from the police force swooping in a helicopter and pulling him out of the wicket.
Oh, wow.
At the start of the movie.
Ooh.
Interesting.
It's actually been dramatized in an audio drama, and you can see why it should never have been made.
Love it.
It's not good. But yeah, but then I think The Wicker Man is one of those classic examples of a movie that's actually better than it could have been. That sort of perfect storm of circumstances and chance and the lightning caught in a bottle of the cast being perfect for it.
Yeah.
Meant that you had this film that, you know, Robin Hardy didn't distinguish himself as a director, you know. Anthony Schaffer's sequel to The Wicker Man clearly shows he had no idea where it was going to go next. Like, mm-hmm. there's explicitly supernatural stuff that happens in the sequel
mm-hmm.
and things. Like, the magic starts working. It's It was going to be made 10 years later, and the failure of the sacrifice would have caused everybody on the island to age magically 10 years. Meanwhile, Sergeant Howie would, of course, be horribly burned, and that would disguise the fact that he was not the same guy who went in. So,
interesting.
Like, there's a whole lot of stuff in that sequel plan that you just look at and go, yeah, no.
Yeah.
It just, so you have a film that almost accidentally raises these issues,
mm-hmm.
that makes these things happen when it might not otherwise have done so.
Yeah. Now I'm stuck on the sequel and like how.
Oh, I'm so like, sorry. Again, he wouldn't have even.
Well, and part of it, so I, during and just before the pandemic, I was working as a hospital chaplain. And so there are like certain medical things that I actually have a deep knowledge of. And so thinking about right? And thinking about like the burning of the Wicker Man. He would have died way before he ever got burned, right? Like
the smoke inhalation.
Amount of smoke would have killed him. And so like
he wouldn't have been able to belt out Psalm 23.
Right. And like there's no rescue. There's no rescue by that time. And like to survive with lots of burns, like the only way that happens is when you are on fire, not when your surroundings are on like. So now I'm like completely picking apart the whole thing. I was like holding back and not talking about like the way his death was actually unrealistic, but then you opened the can of worms. So
yeah, well, I mean yes, I think that there's a point at which sometimes a sequel makes the previous film immeasurably worse just by what it does to the original.
Yeah,
like the second Candyman movie is kind of abysmal.
I haven't seen.
I mean, the first Candyman movie's got its problems, but the second Candyman movie is terrible. And let's not even talk about the third one. the recent one, which is essentially literally exists to make the first Candyman a better movie, is kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you often find sequels or like, oh my gosh, Alien Covenant. Oh my goodness.
Is that coming up for us?
Yes, that's going to be in two seasons, Emily.
Are you doing Alien Spoiler. Covenant?
We're going to be covering the Alien franchise in two seasons.
Oh wow, in two whole seasons.
Not next season, but the season after.
Oh, the next season. Right, you've got it planned out. Wow.
We did some fiving on like Enneagram fiving.
I mean the Wicker Man is there. Is this the bit where we rate the film, include our favorite kill, and have concluding
sure
thoughts?
Let's do it. Let's go right into it. So go for it. How would you rate the film, and do you have a favorite kill?
How many kills are in the film, Emily?
There are actually a lot if you count non-human kills.
Well, fair.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what's your favorite kill?
I mean, it's still the cop. I'm a vegetarian. Kill the cop first. My favorite kill is the cop. Also, because I'm not a big horror film person, we have a like jump count. How many times did I jump during the movie? The answer is one.
When did you jump in the movie?
The Hand of Glory, when he wakes up and sees the Hand of Glory and reacts, so like his jump react to the Hand of Glory.
Like the head of a dead guy with candles on it.
Made me jump.
It's like, yeah. Wait, what? it's a great moment. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was your favorite kill?
Which one of us are you asking? Me?
Both, either? Both? I don't know.
Okay. My favorite kill are the apples, which were kind of the MacGuffin for the whole plot. Kidding. No, it's the cop. Of course it's the cop.
Yeah,
but It's just such a spectacular scene. Like you said, it even makes it onto the cover of these films now, just because it's like so iconic, even though it reveals the ending, of course.
It, yeah.
I mean, it didn't ruin it for me. I still didn't know.
I mean, you didn't give it a rating.
I was gonna like let you say your favorite kill and then rate it, but
okay. Oh, well, my favorite kill is obviously Sergeant Howie, you know.
Yep.
Because it's the only human kill in the movie. But yeah, and also he just does it so it's just I mean it's so completely unrealistic, but that lack of realism is for drama.
Yes. Well, and it's the camp part, right? Like, but this is so unrealistic. It is campy in its portrayal.
And I mean, it's no less realistic than people breaking into Song Around a Maypole with a full band, Monty.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, with a full, like, full-on song and dance number where everybody joins in at the perfect moment. They're kids. They don't do that. And it's just, it's part of the whole thing, the camp nature of it. And I think a lot of people miss the camp, fantastical nature of the film. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing explicitly supernatural about it.
Yeah.
So rating. We've been rating, because we're in the Nightmare on Elm Street season, we've been rating out of nightmares, out of 10 nightmares. So you get to pick how many out of 10 nightmares. Would you like to go first as our guest?
Well, I mean, it's... well, that's different, because if it was just like straight score out of 10, I'd give it a 10. But it's not, because it's one of my favorite films, but it's not really a film that gives you nightmares, is it? It's like, you know, it's only about 3 or 4 nightmares, you know?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I've rated like a 9 out of 10, and I feel like the nightmare of it is, This is just testament to how great of an actor Christopher Lee is, and you already mentioned it, that flash of shadow on his face as soon as he realizes, oh shit, I'm next. And it's just that brief moment. And it's like, that is that ongoing sense of, ooh, there's some juicy nightmare stuff going on here. So,
That's why I rate. He knows as well. I mean, that's one of the things that makes it so horrible. He knows.
I think I would give it a 7.5. This conversation really helped. I tell people this all the time. It's not until after we have the conversation about it that I can actually give the movie itself a rating. So I will give it a 7.5. It's much better having had this conversation than like right when it ended and I was like, but. And it was
for those of you listening at home, that was a fantastic face.
Yes.
By the way. Right.
It's just like But it was a conservative horror film. And I was like, and Susanna even when we were done watching, was like, why did Pace choose this film? Like, why Pace? Why? To be able to then like pick it apart and talk about it and kind of do all of that, and to hear about how it informs all of the films that, like, the other folk horror films.
Yeah, and it is regularly described as the greatest British horror movie, period.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't. A lot of these films that are described as like the greatest movie of their type, there are lots of reasons as to why that's subjective and why they might not be.
Yeah,
but you can't actually let that not be in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this has been absolutely delightful. You've both been so really, really patient and accommodating hosts, and let me witter on.
You have also been very patient, especially with our technology. So,
right?
Oh, well,
and like the fascinating. Behind the scenes Google Docs drama that poor Howard and I were having this morning. Yeah,
you guys binge your Google Doc, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know.
Still, I got there.
Yeah,
Indeed. Well, Howard, where can our listeners find you or upcoming projects? Shameless plugs all around.
All right. Well, I'm currently in the final stages of a book called The Question in Bodies, which was funded by the Horror Writers Association Rocky Woods Scholarship for Nonfiction, which is incredibly proud to have that. It bought my laptop. She's called Cheryl. And and that's coming as soon as I finally finish this epic essay on the second Suspiria and a lot of things. You can find a lot of my writing on room207press.com, and you can find me on Patreon, where you can find some of my writing and also some videos and audio stuff as well on patreon.com/HowardDavidIngham. Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, I am How the Wood Moves. If Twitter is still there by the time this podcast releases.
That right. is a daily question. It's true. It's true.
It could be gone any day.
Truth.
In the twinkling of an eye.
Yeah. Indeed.
This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for being
so much fun. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. For our listeners, our next movie will be Krampus, 2015, ooh, directed by Michael Dougherty. Am I saying that right?
It depends on whether he's British or American.
Yeah.
Right?
He's
so British. How
is Dougherty?
Dougherty. Yeah. Okay. Dougherty or Dougherty. yeah. And this
I'll be dropping Christmas Day.
Yeah. This will be one of the few movies where Christmas is not my first time seeing it.
Oh, good. So
that's
don't take a shot next
year.
Time then. Yeah, well, thank you again so much. This was fantastic. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BoobTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, so much cheaper than a ticket for a ferry to get to a remote island. Yeah, to Summer Island. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD, if it's still around, for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, remember, the maypole is a phallus, which is a penis.